Hello and welcome to How Many Geese? I'm Jack Badhams.
And I'm Roddy Shaw.
And if you're looking for a nature podcast that doesn't take itself too seriously,
then we are The Natural Selection.
On today's show.
That is insane and also the most incredibly loose description of the word milk I've ever heard.
Foul-legged creatures of Mordor that sort of exist and scuttle about the earth. Ugh.
It was, as you've so eloquently put it, the double shits.
Jack Badhams.
Roddy Shaw.
I, today, have something a little bit outside of my normal wheelhouse, because I think, for the first time, possibly in goose history, as best as I can remember, I'm actually going with something led by science.
Yes. Get out. If there's not a Victorian eccentricity, if there's not an escaped zoo animal in this, then I don't know what to do.
None of the above. I also have for us, though, in presenting this topic, and it might become apparent to you why I have departed from my usual find a nutter in history and see what they were up to approach, I am positing that this is our first ever prequel episode.
Oh, we're building out the universe.
We're building out the universe, but we're building out the universe to something that you and I have actually already done and recorded, unreleased at the time of this.
Ooh.
However, it's in the pipeline that everyone's going to listen to, and I thought we could maybe set it up by underpinning something with a layer of science.
I see. Okay, I think it's just clicked in my head where we're going.
Pieces might be falling into place. But I also think that in doing this, it's time we spoke about an animal that we haven't really focused on before, or when we have focused on it, it has been exclusively in a bad light.
I think feel like we've given shade to a lot of animals, dolphins in particular. But you're saying we've not featured them very much.
I don't think we have ever really included this animal as the sole focus of a topic before. And I am using this to feature an animal, setting up a later episode which actually features another animal.
Okay, so it's not the animal that's coming up in the later episode.
It's not the animal that you're thinking.
So is this an animal that we've featured in, like, when we're answering questions and things like that, do you think? Is it one of our sort of go-to animals?
Do you know what? It's almost a trick question. But the animal that I actually want to talk about is us.
Get out of here.
It's human beings.
How many humans?
We're flipping the script. We're leaving the animal world behind. Yeah. Because I actually found something out about humans that separates us from the rest of the animal kingdom in a way that I had no idea human biology did.
Okay.
So if I said to you some of the traits that make humans really different, what might pop to mind?
The fact that we measure the food that we eat in Michelin stars. I don't know. So from a biological perspective, obviously I'm going to say intelligence. That's the one that, you know, we always go for. We are learning that other animals are incredibly clever, but our intelligence coupled with our little old opposable thumbs mean that we have ruled the world.
So intelligence is one which sets us out from the crowd, certainly, right? And the one that everyone maybe thinks of is really separating ourselves from the animal kingdom. Then there's a second one, which is it's a physical trait.
Now, I also believe that we are, but this is only in the mammals, we're the only truly bipedal mammal. And the closest things that get to us in that are kangaroos, but they're not truly bipedal because they have to sort of put their front legs down when they're walking slowly. But that obviously birds are bipedal, and there's lots of other there's lots of bipedal birds. So that's not setting us apart from the animal kingdom as much as the mammals. So I wouldn't actually know.
What about how there's a group, I think Kalahari Bushmen, and how they hunt animals that really sets us apart?
Running.
Yep, so that's the second one, which usually comes up.
We have done that, actually. We have, we spoke, I can't remember in which episode or why it came up, but we spoke about endurance hunters and that humans have the ability to run and run and run because, well, I mean, humans are supposed to, I should say, have the ability to run and run and run because we are able to sweat, and we can actually in under the heat of the African sun, you've got these people in Africa who still hunt antelope and gazelles and things like that by chasing them down until the animal just collapses from exhaustion and the humans are still able to keep going. So our endurance hunting, I guess,
is a second big one. But the third one, and this is the one which I have just found out, which I had never really thought of before, but it is our relationship with milk is completely unique.
Our relationship with it.
Yeah.
that we turn it into chocolate. That's pretty unique. You don't see pufferfish doing that, do you?
Biologically speaking, we are completely unique in being the only animal which drinks milk past infancy.
That makes sense. Yeah.
And there's an entire... It's not just like a cultural thing as such. There is an entire biological underpinning that actually allows us to do this in a way that no other animal can. And it is in itself completely unique in human evolutionary history.
Oh, that's... It is. Now I'm thinking about it and stewing on it. Are we also the only animal that drinks the milk of another animal?
I would hazard a guess, yes, but we're not going down that path.
No, but you're making me feel very self-conscious about milk and how actually quite strange it is, because it's not even just that we drink milk beyond infancy, because when you said that, it made me think, well, all other animals are drinking the milk of their own species. We're not even drinking our own species' milk past infancy. In fact, the weird thing about humans is that we would think it's weird to drink the milk of our own species past infancy. That would be mind-blowingly odd, when actually us drinking the milk of a completely different species is just normal. That's insane.
It's the dairy special. So, let's start this whole thing off by working out what even is milk.
Yeah, help me out here.
Right. So, milk, for the science phrase, milk is an emulsion or colloid, whatever that may be.
Neither of them sound lovely. They both sound horrible. Emulsion or colloid.
Oh, wait until you work out where milk evolved from. Okay. Milk is an emulsion of butterfat globules within a water-based fluid that contains dissolved carbohydrates and protein aggregates with minerals. So because it is basically a collection of stuff, it's not one thing designed to feed and support the young, and it's got everything a growing mammal might need.
Yep.
Because, of course, milk is mammals' superpower.
Yes. I mean, it's literally in the name.
It's the mammalian magical substance. Yeah. And I mentioned you might not like to know where it came from. Do you want to take any swings at what milk evolved from?
I got two guesses. Yep. Blood or sweat.
It evolved as a glandular skin secretion an estimated 310 million years ago. So milk is very, very jazzy sweat.
Oh, lovely.
And it's actually things like platypus and echidnas, the monotremes, don't actually have, I was about to say, clean nipples. Don't have, like, clearly defined nipples, and they basically do just sort of sweat out their milk. So even today, there are mammals that are still doing it in that ancestral way of a glandular skin secretion.
Mm.
Now, you mentioned that, you know, humans are weird just in the fact that we're doing it anyway. Do you want to take a swing at how many people worldwide consume milk and milk products out of a population of 8 billion people?
I reckon there may be large parts of the world not consume it in the same way. I'm going to say 5 or 6 billion.
More than an estimated 6 billion people worldwide consume milk and milk products. And between 750 and 900 million people live in dairy farming households.
Oh, wow.
It's like 1 in 8 people, pretty much, are directly connected to milk production. Now, I really want to stress that for the purposes of this segment, I am not going into any manner of climate implications with dairy farming. I do not care that cows fart for the next half an hour. We are just here to chat about milk and humans' evolutionary relationship with it and what milk is and why mammals have a magical substance. So, on that topic, are you ready to play the hit quiz, Mammary Milk Madness?
Yeah.
Five questions, play along at home. Question one, which mammal, Jack Badhams, do you think produces the thickest milk out there?
I think it's going to be something that's like a seal.
Correct with seal. Do you want to take a swing at zeroing in on any?
Is it a walrus?
No, it's not. It's a slightly outside the box one. I mean, well done with seal. Give yourself a point if you played along at home. It is the hooded seal. The hooded seal have their pups on ice floats. So just tiny little patches of ice. And the pups are weaned in 4 days.
What?
And in order to wean them that quickly, the milk they drink is serious juice. Okay? So to put this into context, the milk fat content tells us how thick a milk is. Humans milk fat is 4.4 grams per 100. So 4.4% of human milk is fat. Cow milk, between 3 to 4%. Sheep, coming in at 7. Goats, 4.1. Horses, 1.2%. A very thin bisque for the connoisseur. Hooded seals have 60% fat in their milk.
Jesus. I want to eat a twirl made out of that.
I mean, yeah, it's pretty much like drinking ganache.
Oh, why did we stop at cows? There's so many other options out there.
If you want to open the world's first hooded seal farm.
If I open the world's first hooded seal dairy, then how many geese is coming along?
Yeah, our first foray into merchandise isn't stickers or t-shirts. It's hooded seal milk. Get ready for it. It's going to blow up on TikTok. So that's the thickest milk out there. Now the thinnest milk. So I said horses were 1.2%.
So the animal with the least fat in its milk, we're talking.
The least fat in its milk.
Now, could this be something that takes a long time to grow? Or, but then those animals are quite big. We're talking whales and things like that. I think they're going to have pretty thick milk. Are we talking maybe, I'm going to go a type of mouse or shrew or rodent?
It is. You were on the right path at the beginning. It is the black rhino.
Oh, so it is a big animal that takes a long time.
It is a big animal, and it's the fact that it takes a long time which plays a part. So if you remember, the hooded seal weaned its young in 4 days, so the mother only has to produce that ridiculously energy-intensive milk for 4 days, like, you know, ganache. So the black rhino comes in with 0.2% milk fat content, and that is because they have a long nursing period of around about 2 years, and the juice would exhaust the mother.
How? And this is showing the demographic of your hosts. How long is the human weaning period?
I don't know.
Okay.
Well, hang on. I mean, is it mad to think... That is mad. Well, I was looking at, if human milk fat is 4.4% and cow milk is 4% and sheep milk is 7%, I was going to say, does that mean that we wean for less time than sheep? But that's insane, because
there are women,
they're done in a couple months or something.
There are women shouting at us right now. Like,
oh, yeah, but I'd like to think we're being self-aware enough. So, highest protein in milk.
Ooh, the highest protein. Surely it's got to be a meat-eating animal.
You're going to be thoroughly disappointed.
Oh, I was going to say polar bear or something.
It is the cottontail rabbit.
Get it in the rabbit.
Now, animals that spend a lot of time away from their young, so babies that might need to be left behind, have very protein-rich milk, so that a small sip of milk gives the baby everything it needs to be able to grow whilst the mother is away.
Right.
I also would have thought a carnivore, but it's a really weird relationship there, that it's a tiny little rabbit has this...
Yeah.
You know, like you got gym bros coming out and it's all like max gains, energy power, you know, instant growth. Trying to advertise cottontail rabbit drink. Next up, two more questions. How are you doing along at home? We've got the jazziest nipples.
Oh, now, are we talking... Can we define jazzy, please?
Nipples.
Because I've seen some humans with pretty jazzy nipples.
And people are back to shouting at us. The nipples capable of the most multitasking.
Okay, I'm wildly stabbing in the dark here where this could go. Multitasking, I have no idea. So I'm going to throw out a random bizarre animal and say that something like a colugo has got weird things going on with its nipples.
Full marks for picking a bizarre animal. It is, in fact, wallabies, because they can produce two different sets of milk at once from different nipples, because they have two young at different life stages.
That's cool.
Growing in the womb and outside of the womb, so they can have one nipple, because when marsupials are born, they're like the size of a jelly bean, and they pop out of the mother, and then they crawl their way into the pouch, and they latch onto a nipple, and they basically do, in a sense, what, you know, humans are doing in the womb inside the pouch,
the
right?
Pouch.
And that tiny little jelly bean wallaby will be getting one type of milk. And then once it grows and is out exploring, it moves to another type of milk. But the mother will have had another jelly bean move into the pouch. Mm. So a different nipple with a different milk and fat content for each different young, which takes the word jazziest nipples.
Definitely the jazziest nipples. And I've definitely never seen a human do that. So fair play.
No, and now let me know if you've seen a human do this, because our final question on mammary milk madness is most horrific milk.
Most horrific milk? Is this? Are you about to tell me that you've taste tested all of them? And this is Ronnie Shaw's, you know, like the Schmidt Pain Index. This is the Shaw. This is the Shaw.
The Shaw Milk Index.
Most horrific milk. Is there a milk that is? Do you mean horrific? Is there like a trait? Is it red or something?
When I tell you about this, you will be disgusted.
I'm going to throw an animal at this, and I'm going to say, what animal do I think has the capability for mad milk? A hyena.
Hyena, good guess. I will be honest, your host has tricked you again with another trick question, because the animal with the most horrific milk, it could be argued, well, it is straight up not actually a milk, but it is a milk-like substance made by Sicilians. Now, Sicilians are worm-like amphibians under the ground, and we set this whole thing up with saying that milk was the magic of mammals. But there are one or two other things out there which are making weird substances to help feed their young. So the Sicilian is a worm-like amphibian, lives under the ground, and the mother will coil around her young, and around about once a week, the young will eat the mother's own skin off, and the mother will regrow her skin to sustain the young on a weekly basis, which is taking the award for most horrific fucking thing I've heard of this year.
That is insane, and also the most incredibly loose description of the word milk I've ever heard. But yeah, that's wild.
That's what you get on Mammary Milk Madness. So thanks for playing along. Score yourselves and do let us know. Now, we mentioned nipples in there, so let's talk nipples. Specifically, nipple location. Now, I had no idea about this, but I have, like, in a weird way, background wondered, why do, like, cats have loads of nipples and dogs have loads of nipples and humans have nipples at the top and cows and deers have nipples at the back? So nipple location is based on something called milk lines, which when the embryo is really, really, really young, right before sort of sex determination or anything like that, rows of kind of embryonic cells, and they basically run, if you lift your arm above your head and put your finger on your armpit and then run it down to essentially your groin, that line is your nipple line. And so if you can imagine, that's where all of a cat or a dog's nipples go. They go right down there. And then, depending on the animal, throughout evolution, they've either stayed at the top, stayed right the way down, or stayed down at the bottom. So what causes that difference? So option one, you're a deer, you're an ungulate, you're some kind of hoofy thing, and you've got your nipples at the back, right? So you live in a herd, and things are always trying to chase you and eat you. So you need young, which are able to move very fast and very quickly after birth. So you're probably only going to be having around about one very big, strong baby at a time, not a complete litter of things. You spend nearly all your time in your feet, and you've got a very narrow set of shoulders to account for how fast you need to move. You've got one offspring that needs a lot of milk, but it doesn't need a lot of access to different teats. So just having those at the back allows you to be able to run off very quickly because it keeps the top half of your body nice and lean and keeps you both safe. Option two for why they think animals like rats or dogs or cats kept their entire sets of nipples right the way down their body is because these are generally found in animals which create shelters and really nest and really den. So when they are feeding their young, they don't need to be up and alert and looking around like something like a deer needs to be. They can just lie down, completely shut off, completely safe, and have all of their young feeding at once. Which I'd never thought of before, but it's pretty cool bit of like evolution just based on where your nipples are.
And I was thinking pigs have rows of nipples, but actually like boar and things will make sort of temporary nests and things like that.
Yeah. And so then the final one is pretty much the kind of apes, right? So animals which evolved to be swinging around, using their forearms a lot, and the young would be carrying and clinging on to the mother. So you keep the nipples up where, how it fits into the animal's locomotion. Except a couple of weird examples. Elephants have their nipples at the front, despite being, you know, you would have thought perhaps fitting into that nipples at the back category.
Yeah, but I mean, what is going to fuck up an elephant?
Well, I suppose. But an elephant had to get to the point of being an elephant.
Well, that's true. Yeah.
So in terms of evolution, was there a point where the nipples moved back up to the... If you lined up an evolutionary, you know, like the kind of descent of man, but for an elephant, would you just see set of tits moving along it? And the outlier of all things, the eye, has its nipples at the back.
Okay. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say, you know, on its forehead as a third eye or something for a second.
The eye. Right, but I said that we would look at the kind of actual human evolution of the whole thing with milk, right? So that's an overview of milk in general, what it is, what some different animals are doing with it, and just what's up with nipples. But let's get into humans. Because like I said, the really weird thing that humans do with it, and it's pretty much a human superpower, is the fact that we can drink it beyond infancy. In many cultures, especially in the West, humans continue to consume milk beyond infancy, using the milk of other animals, as you pointed out at the start, as a food product. Now, initially, the ability to digest milk was limited to children, as adults did not produce lactase. Now, lactase is the enzyme which breaks down the lactose in the milk. And therefore, we're now talking thousands of years ago in our relationship with milk as it went along, people would convert milk to cheese and curd and other products to reduce the levels of lactose in it. So historically, that was much more consumed than the milk itself. But then thousands of years ago, this chance mutation spread in human populations in northwestern Europe that enabled us to produce lactase into adulthood, which then rendered us the only animals that can convert lactose as adults.
So that was just literally evolution in action. A favorable gene mutates and then spreads through the population.
Around about 10,000 years ago. And it's one of the most kind of recent, genetically nailable, identifiable features. The one thing which they are sort of less sure about is what the specific selection factor for driving it was. But one of the things they think... So in a study published in Nature, researchers compared archaeological evidence for 9,000 years of European milk use with genetics and found an unusually rapid evolution of lactose tolerance among Europeans well after they first started consuming the beverage. So the suggestion is that people were already doing it, but people were already consuming milk for time because they had moved into agriculture and they were producing cheese and they would still have it as a food source, but essentially it'd give you the shits, right? Lactose intolerance. So the authors suggest that it wasn't necessarily that those who could consume milk were fitter, like by default, and fitter in the evolutionary sense, not in like an Olympian sense. So it's not just that being able to eat it made you fitter. It allowed you, in times of famines or pathogens, which may have exacerbated milk's impact on the gastro tract. So everyone is having milk, and everyone is getting the shits except one person who is able to digest it. But everyone can live with the level of shits they're getting because the benefits of the milk and, you know, society and having the cows and everything else. But then a famine comes along and really hammers you, or cholera moves through, and then you're in a situation of having double shits if you're not able to break down milk.
Yes.
So it was the association of sort of other things impacting the lactose tolerance.
It was, as you've so eloquently put it, the double shits.
Look, I said I was bringing science to the table. I wasn't saying I was abandoning the usual goose lingo. I will say it's one thing that particular study published in Nature forgot to mention, the double shits, but I'm glad that we've been able to translate it. This is science communication in action. That's the problem with big research. They are too afraid...
to call a spade a spade.
To call a spade a spade. So once it had gotten into the population, the mutation then allowed milk to be used as a new source of nutrition, which could sustain populations when other food sources failed, and it moved rapidly throughout the population. So lactase persistence is the phrase that technically identifies an individual's ability to break it down. It's the opposite of lactose intolerance. Mm-hmm. Lactase persistence is the continued activity of the enzyme in adulthood, and it is very high among Northern Europeans, especially Irish people. And worldwide, most people are lactase non-persistent and are affected by varying degrees of lactose intolerance as adults. So if we go right back to the start, 6 billion people around the world are consuming milk, but most of the human population is actually intolerant to it. It is this one chance mutation in Northern Europe, which has been spreading rapidly. Yeah. From 10,000 years ago. It did happen in a couple other populations because there's like Mongolian herders who drink horse milk and they've got their own thing going on. But in terms of evolution, this sudden spike to drinking milk and shift to lactase tolerance is really actually quite recent.
Yeah. So there's still large parts of... because I know when you go to places in Asia... milk really doesn't feature quite high, you know, milk often doesn't feature very high in their diets. And are those populations of people still, you know, has the gene not made it there?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Amazing. So it really is that case that it is this working case of evolution.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the last 10,000 years.
Within our own species, which is really
within
cool.
Our own species, yeah. Within what in evolutionary time is the blink of an eye. Yeah. That it's happened in these last 10,000 years that we've suddenly been able to drink milk into adulthood. And now it is a major, major underpinning.
Entire industries.
Yeah, exactly.
I wonder if the gene still has that selective advantage. Now we are in an age where the double shits are less of a worry. Maybe the gene has... It would be interesting to know if we could magically watch the spread of this gene. Has it ground to a halt as its... advantage has maybe become, well, I guess it would have reached cultures where milk wasn't as much of a big thing, and then it wouldn't have needed to persist through there. But I wonder now whether some of that advantage with medicine and dairy alternatives and stuff like that have meant that that gene still carries the same weight in today's age as it did back in, you know, the Iron Age.
So it's, what is the impact of lactose-free ice cream on the evolutionary selection pressure of the double shits?
How many geese investigates? Joint PhD, Dr. Badhams and Shaw.
But I said that this was a prequel episode in terms of looking at our relationship with milk. Because, Jack, we have been somewhere which we will be bringing to the people in a matter of weeks, specifically tied to humans and milk. Do you want to let everyone know where we went?
The maddest place we've ever been, and we have been to the jungle. We went to the UK's only camel dairy farm. Yeah. And that doesn't do it justice, because the camels there are also used for films and weddings and... racing and all sorts of stuff. Yes, we went to Joseph's Amazing Camels in Warwickshire and had an absolutely amazing day in a special episode that, as you mentioned, will be coming out in a few weeks.
Sometime in April or May. So watch the Instagram page to stay posted on when that comes out. But I figured you know, we were so swept up in the camel of it all in the visit there that I ended up going on a bit of a rabbit hole about milk and learning that humans actually have quite an interesting evolutionary connection to milk, and the things about like the fat content and the nipples, nipple lines. Who knew?
How many geese got milk?
How many geese got milk?
Listeners, we have a new sponsor. It's time for the BirdFi segment. Yes, you heard correctly. It's the BirdFi segment because we've got some new friends. Now, BirdFi are in the Bird Box and Bird Feeder game, but they do not stop there because everything these days is smart. We've got smart TVs. Your watch is smart. It's high time that the bird feeders were smart too. Smart technology smashed it into the bird feeders. We're combining those two worlds that we were all crying out for, that they had to come together. And we're showcasing our friends BirdFi, who have combined bird feeders and bird boxes with cutting-edge camera technology that not only detects birds and sends notifications straight to your phone when they visited one of these things, but also, one, automatically records it so that you've got those moments to look back on your phone. But two, and this is the really cool thing, it identifies the birds for you. So the company that's actually behind BirdFi, they were mainly making security cameras and then saw that lots of the people were sharing the birds that they'd seen on the security cameras. And now they've got, like I've said, bird feeders, bird houses. They've got hummingbird feeders for the very lucky listeners that are over in the Americas, which
we are not.
Is not us. And as we've spoken about on the show before, I believe when we did a bit about which non-native animal would you release, hummingbird was my shout. Eternally jealous of the folks that have got hummingbirds in their back gardens.
Yeah, very cool.
So, what we have wanted to do, Goose fans, is we're not going to bring you a product placement on how many geese that we're not involved with, that we're not proud to promote, that we don't believe in. So right now, as we speak, one of their FSC certified bamboo bird feeders is winging its way to us, and we're going to get it out and see what comes to it and let you know over the coming episodes what we're seeing on this bird feeder. Now, the key thing is, where are we putting said bird feeder? Because we could have put it in my garden up here in lovely Derbyshire, and it would have all been very twee, and we would have got lots of little lovely birds coming to it. But Roddy Shaw, there isn't a bird that's visited my garden that I'm not aware of. There isn't a bird that's set foot on lawn or leaf that has evaded my detection. So BirdFi is all about making products that makes birds accessible and easy to engage with. So the Team Goose Feeder is on its way to the big smoke, to London, and into the hands of our very own Roddy Shaw. Roddy, where are we putting this bird feeder?
I'll be honest, Jack, at time of recording, it's a great question.
Because you live in a flat.
On the seventh floor.
On the seventh floor, yeah.
Which I will say, at time of recording, in fact, hot off the press, as of 20 minutes ago, I found out there's a pigeon nesting on my balcony, which has laid an egg.
That's hot content.
So I'm going to have to put the bird fi somewhere else because the balcony's just been taken. Don't know if you've seen the memes of pigeon nests, yeah, listeners, but they are abstract at best and pretty far removed from the concept of nest making as most birds understand it. So I don't know. Where I work, my day job office has a garden. I might reach out to some friends who have gardens. One of my friends lives on a boat. Don't know what we think about putting it on a boat, so it'd be a mobile situation, but that might raise security issues. Anyway, we will get this camera bird feeder set up somewhere in the big smoke to see what birds appear, when, where, and how.
And this is the great thing about these cameras is I can be up here and still seeing what's coming to it, even when it's in Derbyshire, because I get notifications just saying. So you can put it up anywhere. You know, you put it up in your garden, even if you're on the other side of the world, you can still see what's coming to it. Now, on that note, actually, there's three birds that I've actually seen from your from your balcony. Yep. If any of those turned up on the bird feeder, well, the feral pigeon is one of them. I've seen ringneck parakeets from your balcony. Yep. They'd be quite fun. I've also seen peregrine falcons from your balcony. So stock it up with steak and we'll see what happens.
Yeah, if we get a peregrine falcon coming in for some sunflower seed, it will shake the ornithological world to its core. Yeah. So fingers crossed, everyone, that we break really new ground.
So go and check out BirdFi. That's BIRDFI. Now is a great time to get especially one of their bird boxes just as we get into spring. And the designs of some of these things are really cool. The nest box is very cool. It's very Scandi. It's got like all these, you know, it's very like, yeah, it's very, very nice. Anyway.
Hygge living. Yeah, it's got, what is it, the candles and sheepskin rugs
like,
and whatever.
If you're thinking bird box camera, you think you know what this thing looks like. I guarantee you don't know what this thing looks like. Although, I mean, it's a box, okay? Mm. We're not talking, it's not an abstract shape. It's still a box and it's still designed for birds. But it's very, very stylish. And it's got two cameras in it, like one on the outside as well. It's all very professional. Anyway. This is our little BirdFi journey. Over the next few episodes, we will be bringing you what we see down in the Big Smoke.
And in the event that the Big Smoke lets us down, we've now got a pigeon on the balcony who we can give you updates on too. So either way, urban birding is about to pop off.
It's time for that part of the show where we take one of nature's magnificent creatures and we pit it against Roddy Shaw in a fight to the death. Now, today's animal has been submitted on Instagram by Miss Betty Black, and it is the weaver bird. Let's get to know our foe. We are specifically talking the village weaver here, a small 15-centimetre, mainly yellow bird that hails from much of sub-Saharan Africa and have now been introduced to some Caribbean islands. Caribbean? Don't know what I did there. Mauritius and Reunion. They're a pretty successful species that do particularly well around human habitation. They like to feed on seeds and grain and so will form large colonies around towns and villages. Of course, the thing that gives the weaver bird its name is their amazing nest-building feats. They weave together up to 300 long strips of palm or grasses to make amazing hanging nests, with the entrance hanging vertically downwards to make it harder for predators, particularly snakes, to access them. They nest colonially together, with sometimes as many as 150 nests all together hanging in a single tree. So, Roddy Shaw, how many village weavers are too many village weavers?
So I quite like this one because its home is such an integral part of the animal.
Yes, they are defined by the nest they make.
Exactly. And so, I mean, it's villainous of me to think this way, but it does feel like I'm not just taking them down, I'm taking the village down.
Yeah. Like, it's a bit Hot Fuzz.
Yes, but it's also a bit, I've got Fee-Fi-Fo-Fum sort of giant coming for the village.
Right, I see.
Energy. Oh, you've got the model village.
I had the like Nicholas Angel taking down the village vibes.
Oh.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the village weavers might be very protective of their village. You know, that sort of for the greater good.
Oh, you think they've got a kind of Wicker Man.
sort of vibe.
Okay. How big are we saying they are? Starling?
Well, about 15 centimetres, so a bit smaller. I mean, we caught those weaver birds in, I don't know if you remember, we caught those weaver birds in Madagascar.
No, I do remember it very... About, yeah.
That sort of size.
Okay. And did you say they've been introduced? Where are they?
So they've been... Their natural range is right across a lot of sub-Saharan Africa, but they have now been introduced to islands in the Caribbean, so like Hispaniola, Puerto Rico, and then Mauritius, Reunion Islands in the Indian Ocean.
These aren't the ones... There was something... Oh, I think it was a parrot now that made big nests in Europe?
In London.
Oh.
On the Isle of Dogs.
Oh.
There was the monk parakeet, which we spoke about in one of our topics on invasive species that were eradicated from the UK before they could become a big problem. But you're right, in Europe, they are very well established. And the monk parakeets make huge colonial nests that are so big and heavy that when they get wet, they can topple trees. If they build them on pylons, they're a risk of fire. Whereas the weaver birds are more individual, hanging from trees. They make their own individual hanging nest, but like a Christmas tree, they're all hung together like baubles on a big tree. You know, what's their motive going to be for attacking you? I think they're very... It's something to do with the village element.
I was thinking, what's the village vibe?
Yeah.
There's a...
They are noisy. They're described as being noisy. They're described as... if you live near, because they live near towns and villages, they live in like the grounds of hotels and things like that. And they can be quite loud and raucous. And it's constantly little birds going backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards. They make these nests, 300 strips of palm or grass to make these nests. And they can only carry one at a time and then weave it into their nest. So they're constantly back and forth, back and forth. It's hive of activity, this village.
Do we have any idea, parking the whole segment for a second, do we have any idea how weaver birds learnt to do this? Because the nests are insane.
Yeah, it is amazing.
Like, insane.
There is a great segment to be done on nests. I don't know. I went to an amazing exhibition all about nests in, I think it was the Bristol Museum when I lived down there. And it was, they'd got weaver bird nests, they'd got long-tailed tit nests, they'd got oropendula nests, which make really cool hanging ones as well. And how they're just born with this innate instinct and never taught how to do it is ridiculous.
Yeah, but the village must die.
Such are the rules of the game.
The rules of the game. Right. I quite like the hot fuzz, greater good, they want to keep the village safe, but I also feel the weak link in the chain of a village is gossip and rumours.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, as someone who lives in a pretty small village myself, the village Facebook page is quite something. I reckon the weaver birds have got a very active village Facebook page.
Oh my God, I bet they do. And it's like, I'm not saying names.
Yeah.
Exactly. But number 43 has once again got a bin that's fallen over. I'm not saying names, but, you know.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't even be that, would it? It would be, I'm not saying names, but the house between number 41 and 43.
Yeah, so what you'd need to do, I think, is you, as a method of attack, could stoke the flames.
Cambridge Analytica.
Of the
Russian bots. We're going deep state on the village Facebook group.
Absolutely.
How many of them live together in a communal village?
So the most that you can get all together is around 150. They're the biggest ones.
And they're all about 15 centimetres.
Yeah.
So even if it came to fisticuffs.
And that's pairs, sorry. So that's individual nests, 150 nests. So for each pair,
300 birds.
Yeah, 300 birds.
How much do they weigh?
Between 20 and 40 grams, something
so,
like that.
Right. So I reckon I could easily take down a single village.
Yeah.
And I reckon once I've done... So it is going to be village Facebook grouped.
Yeah.
I'm coordinating some kind of online response. I'm stoking the flames. Yeah. I've got bot accounts.
Posting under anonymous accounts.
And, exactly. Yeah. And then having further anonymous accounts commenting under those posts to build momentum, build hype, get the engagement, get the links going.
And I should say, sorry, from my own personal experience of Facebook group, of the village Facebook group, it doesn't take much because some people will literally just post. Somebody posted on our Facebook group, a bit worried about some, I think someone had trespassed on their lawn or something like that. They posted it anonymously.
Yeah.
It said anonymous participant
user,
or whatever.
Yeah,
yeah, anonymous user. Because they thought that someone might be trying to rob their house. And because they'd posted it anonymously, two or three people jumped on them and were like, why are you posting it anonymously? Something to hide. And it's like, no, I was just worried that criminals might come and get me. So it really doesn't take much.
Yep, and I reckon a single post or two, well-timed and well-angled about snakes. Snakes in the village.
There's been snakes in the village.
Yeah. And then a whole village is collapsing.
Yeah.
So easily a single village.
Yeah. I think they're probably quite isolated in their villages.
I think
they're probably a bit like, oh, they're not from the village. So I don't think they, you know, I think it's not like they're suddenly going to have backup coming to help them. It's very every village for themselves in the Village Weaver community.
Okay. So I've just Googled the difference between a village and a town.
Right.
And what I've got is that a town has both a local government and fixed boundaries. So I think I could take up to a town's worth of weaver birds.
Yeah.
Basically, once a number of villages come together to the point of forming a local government,
yeah,
I think that's where they're able to coordinate a response to my social media bots.
Rather than the Facebook mob mentality.
So long as they're at village level, I could take village after village after village individually.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is it's endless villages until they constitute themselves as a town. Then it's game over.
That's how many village weavers.
Yeah. So, I have a question here from Ruth Eliza Mack on Instagram. And I am really excited for this one. In part because I myself, well, I'll say it after, but all transport in the UK is being replaced with animals. Who's doing what? For example, millipede train. So I'm looking at this in a kind of Pixar Bug's Life type way, where the big beetle comes in and lifts up its wing and everyone gets off. Mm-hmm. And the reason I mention I'm particularly excited for this is because I have to get a 5-hour train tomorrow. And I don't know what our international listeners may know or think about the UK rail infrastructure, but it is a godforsaken hellscape. So let's work out which animal I would rather be on instead of LNER heading to Glasgow.
So I think millipede, good start. For me, it's too slow.
Yeah.
So I would go millipede. For me, millipede is the London Underground.
Okay.
Not that the Underground is particularly slow, but it's slower than high speed rail, and it's going through tunnels. And millipedes are often in under leaf litter in the detritus. So the millipede sort of pulling up to the tube station. That for me, the millipede is the tube rather than the trains.
Okay, so are we doing this in a kind of Pixar sense where it's like if we were to animate, if we were to Bug's Life, if we were to Zootopia the UK,
yeah,
which animal would be animated in? Because, it wouldn't be like a hollowed out millipede that we'd all get it, you know, like it.
You'd get on, exactly.
Okay, cool. So millipedes for the
and we can and as made clear in the question from Ruth.
Yep.
Ruth
Eliza Mack.
As made clear in the question from Ruth, we can supersize. We can work with the animal size.
Play with the genre. Yes.
So I'm saying millipede for tube.
Okay.
And then for high speed rail, I'm saying Scolopendra centipede.
Terrifying.
But then if you were in front of the LNER Azuma service to London, that would also be quite terrifying.
Well, that is true. What about the black... Okay, we're obviously going on the long animals here.
Yes.
What about a black mamba as the fastest snake?
Ooh, yeah. Only thing with a black mamba is you're going to have to make the train line at least twice as wide to account for the bends as it's going.
For the wiggles, yes. But you're maybe gonna
get a little bit more motion sick than you would on a centipede which is going in a straight line. But I see, you know, black mamba I think is a good shout. Very fast snake.
Do centipedes go dead straight? There's no wiggle in a centipede. A millipede is definitely trudging along dead straight.
You might be right there. I think centipedes do have a bit of a wiggle on. So yeah.
Okay. I tell you what it would not bloody be, and I want to veto, well, I don't even have to veto it because we've already done the London Underground, but my head just went underground caves, cave centipedes. They are horrific.
Yeah.
Just foul-legged creatures of Mordor that sort of exist and scuttle about the earth. Ugh.
I think talking about underground, though, I know I've said millipede, but I'd quite like to be... I feel like it would be very nice to be taken around on a mole.
Yes.
Very soft and velvety. Maybe that's the premium package.
I think mole is a very kind of Harry Potter world-esque type thing. Mm. You know, await your mole cart and then it sort of shuffles in and you...
It's very Gringotts Bank, isn't
exactly. it? Exactly. Exactly. Okay. So rail, are there any other types of rail?
Tram. What would be... What would tram would just be? What's an animal that we thought was a good idea once?
The evolution. What's an animal that evolution had at a time that was a good idea, but has since been like, this was a wild infrastructure misfire?
Pandas. Pandas are the definition of bad infrastructure.
Yes. Oh my God. And the only pandas in the UK were in Edinburgh, and Edinburgh spent bloody years getting its trams built. So...
So there we go. Pandas are trams.
Panda trams. So we've got panda trams. We've got...
Tramdas.
Tramdas. We've got tramdas. We've got the Millipede Tube. We've got the Black Mamba Express. Now we are into bus / coach. So municipal bus, inner city bus, and intercity coaches. So one of them, I suppose, has to be... Oh, like a possum. Don't opossums carry like all of their young?
That's a good shout, because I was going to say bus, like the defining feature of British buses is double decker.
Are they uniquely British?
I don't know, but when people think, you know, whenever I've been in America and other countries, I can't bring to mind seeing a double decker bus.
There's definitely double decker buses in Dublin.
I've seen double decker bus, double decker trains.
Yeah.
When we went to Belgium.
Yeah.
But we don't have those in the UK.
No, that'd they're very cool. exciting.
But I do think it's a quintessentially British thing, is the double-decker bus.
Yeah, the red.
Might not be unique, but it's very British.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going with a possum.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Which carry all their young as they kind of trundle about. But is there any difference in what we're putting forward for a coach?
Coach, sort of long distance, bit more luxury.
Bit. Like...
Well, in that you don't have to...
The vagary of luxury.
You don't have to press a grubby button that a million other people have pressed before you.
No, you just get to sit next to a toilet on a bus is the worst toilet.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the worst public infrastructure toilet, is the toilet on a bus.
Maybe a coach is, I'm thinking, one of the animals from the Great Plains of Africa. Because they do get around, you know, they do move around a bit. You don't want to be sat next to the toilet on something like a wildebeest.
And they have, like, oxpeckers.
Yeah.
Little birds that sit on them and go around. So maybe I'll take a wildebeest.
Wildebeest or a buffalo, like a water buffalo.
The Great Migrations.
Yeah.
You know, that's it. It's the wildebeest, which do the Great Migration across land.
Okay.
I think that's your coach, with the little birds on them going, yeah. Okay.
Great. We've not done car. Do we have to do car? Or was it public transport?
Well, it's public transport. I don't know if a taxi counts as that.
No.
I will take a kangaroo taxi.
Oh, okay. Kangaroo taxi. Yeah, let's do it.
Comfort for one. And then honorary mention. It's pretty far from public. Do you know there's a public like cable car? There's a cable car in London that goes over the Thames.
Really?
Which is technically... like a piece of public transport infrastructure.
Well, that's a gibbon.
Yes.
Yeah, that's just swinging.
I had some kind of weaver bird nest.
Okay, I see, on a pulley system.
Yeah, exactly.
There's ferries and things like that. And for me, you've got things like great crested grebes, which are quite known for getting their chicks on their back and ferrying them. You see it with swans as well. Swans get their... chicks on their back, and we do have swan boats anyway. So people are used to that. It wouldn't be as big a change in the mind of the people, because they're used to pedaloing around on ornamental lakes.
Because again, going back to my earlier point, I don't know what people, international listeners, are familiar with about British infrastructure, but the level of pedalos is off the chart. You can't move for pedalos. Pedalo rush hour in London is like nothing you've ever seen. As the many thousands of workers of the financial sector pedal fiberglass swans down to Canary Wharf.
It's the great migration of the British Isles, really, to and from the suburbs. Is that, have we, what else is there? I mean, you've got things like, now you've got, do those electric scooters count?
Oh, it's a rental for one.
Yeah, so it would be like you would rent something small, nippy, can get around. Something that's dodging it. So, like, picture the Great Migration and all the animals and all the cars, basically, on the road. And this is something that can nip in between them, isn't it?
You know the opening of The Lion King in the big circle of life? There's a bit where the camera is down on the floor and, like, elephants and everything are walking towards it and there are guinea fowl running in and amongst their legs. Yeah. I'm going to go with guinea fowl. For the renter.
Renter fowl.
Guinea fowl sort of zipping through the London streets.
I want to live in this world.
It's a good Zootopia we're building up here, isn't it? I suppose lastly then it's just sort of transport of the sky, which is pretty far from public.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. But
I mean, we've said that for everything else.
That's true. Well, okay. Well, yeah. It's surely got to be. The big airliners would be Albatross.
Yeah.
Things like that.
Yeah.
Or Vulture. But if you're on a Vulture or something, I guess you've just got to spiral up and up and up on a thermal before you can... Like, your flights are eight times as long because you've got to cruise around looking for a thermal to go up before you can go across.
And I would like helicopters to be those gigantic prehistoric dragonflies.
Oh, that's a good... That were like the size of... Yeah, birds.
Yeah, except the size of helicopters. So really, it could have been a modern-day dragonfly, because whichever dragonfly I'm starting with, I'm turning it into the size of a helicopter. So the fact that the dragonfly started as the size of a bird is completely bloody arbitrary now that we've worked through it. But we also have Pedalo Rush Hour in this world, so why not have prehistoric dragonflies?
I would vote for whichever party put that forward in their manifesto.
And there's an election this year. So, political candidates, if you're listening, and we know that you are, Rishi and Keir, thinking about your manifestos, you know, maybe think about it.
Give it a thought.
And that was this week's episode of How Many Geese. Thank you very much for listening. Big thank you if you've been telling your friends and sharing it far and wide. We really appreciate it. And all the tags on Instagram help a huge deal too. A massive welcome if you are a new listener. And thank you for coming back to us if you are returning this week. If you want to help the podcast out, hop on over to iTunes. And if you can leave a written review, it massively helps with the algorithm. Or go over to Spotify and leave a review there too. Don't forget, there's the Instagram page to check out at How Many Geese. And if you are feeling extra generous, you can head over to buymeacoffee.com/How Many Geese and leave us a little tip if you're enjoying what we do. Thanks very much. We'll be back next week with more How Many Geese. Cheers. Bye-bye. God, I said How Many Geese a lot.